you were saying, Lou, that you started, your interest in fishing rods really grew out of your own use of them in fishing. And you were fishing with a friend?
Ernie Walker, who was head of the head electrician at the plant, cement plant, and I were fishing in Battle Creek. That was before the TVA dam backed the water up.
Battle Creek is on the north side of the river. Well, it'd be on the south side of the river.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah, around the bend.
And it's it was a beautiful stream, clear water, and they had, in fact, it came out from Martin Springs under the mountain. And up in the early, up in the upper part of the lake, although I never fished for them, there were rainbow trout. I've done a lot of rainbow trout fishing, but not in that stream. But anyway, Ernie, when we were about ready to quit, stood up in this canoe, holding his rod to make one more cast, and fell down. And in the thing, in the accident, he broke the rod. So I said, Ernie, I've never done this before, but let me take this rod and see if I can't repair it. And I did. I completely stripped it of all of the old varnish and windings and guides, put new guides on and new everything, see? And I was just so fascinated with it that that I did my own rods, and by then I was felt like an expert, see?
And this would have been about just roughly what year?
Oh, along in about the 50s.
In the 50s. Well, would this have, would your earlier work as a typewriter mechanic working with little pieces of equipment and fine work, would that have added to this?
It added a degree of patience.
I see.
You see?
Yeah.
I would work on these rods, and at one time I had over 100 fishing rods on my bench down here that needed to be repaired from all over the country. I made a mistake and put a little 1-inch ad in Outdoor Life. But I finally got around to wanting a fishing rod from well-known fishermen. So I originated the idea of, for instance, I wrote John Garner, Cactus Jack Garner, longtime vice president of the United States, and told him that I wanted a rod with FDR on it. And I thought maybe he could get it for me. And I said, I want one of your rods, old rods, I don't care what shape it's in, and I'll make a rod for you. So he come back, and in a little while, I got a letter from the White House. I got this rod from FDR. So I made a rod for him. And then with that bit of success, I decided I'd go on. I wrote Hoover. And several other presidents made rods for them, including the president of Mexico at
that
the time. Miguel Alemán.
Alemán, yeah. I believe he came here.
He did. He made a talk here, and a rod was presented to him here. And the Chamber of Commerce wanted me to present it. That I'd made the rod.
Was that the rod that you made for him, you made one earlier?
No, I made one. That was on. It was going to be presented to him here, see?
I see. Okay.
But I wouldn't do it. I mean, I said, no, let the Chamber of Commerce have all the credit for it, see? And I didn't go down. To digress a minute, I was pretty close to the Bowater folks. I made a gavel from a piece of wood out of the first shipment of wood into the Bowater plant up here at Charleston. And I made it for Sir Eric Bowater. And they wanted me to present that to him when he made a speech down at the Chamber of Commerce speech. And I wouldn't do it. I just said, you just give it to him.
Gracious of you. Well, what?
But anyhow, then I got these rods from, I made one for Irvin S. Cobb, a great humorist, you know, and wrote for the Saturday and Post regularly and all that. And so, and I got a letter from him. He said, brother, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me.
I knew that problem was the most religious he's been a long time.
But I made several rods. I made one for Estes Kefauver.
You made one for Eisenhower, and I think you gave one to Eisenhower.
I presented the Eisenhower's rod was the only one that I presented in person.
Wait, did you go to Washington?
Oh, yeah. I was going to Washington anyway for a Kiwanis
convention.
And I wrote you see, I'd been working on a rod, you know, and about got it finished, and I wrote to Frazier, Congressman Frazier, and asked him if he could get an appointment with the president so that I could present this rod to him. And it was a month and a half or so before the convention before I heard from Frazier after I wrote him. So anyway, I finally called him. And I only had about 2 days, you see, to get to New York. And he said, I just wrote you. The president will be glad to see you at so-and-so in the morning at this particular day. Told me to go to Northwest Gate, and I'd be expected. So I had a friend drive me and my wife up there. And the night before my date, the Rosenbergs were to be executed at Sing Sing. And we took a practice shot, so to speak, the night before I was to see the president. And the sidewalks were full of placards and so forth that had been discarded by people who were trying to get a reprieve from the president for the Rosenberg. So I pulled up at one of the gates. There's about five or six guard stations, not a gate at every one, but we pulled up, saw this guard right there at the fence. And I asked him, I said, I've got a date with the president. He said, you mean tonight? I said, no, sir, no, it's in the morning, and I want to ask where the Northwest Gate is. So he said, just drive to the corner, take your right, drive to that corner, take your right, and the Northwest Gate's right there. So I pulled into the Northwest Gate on time. And of course he saw the Tennessee tag. And it was in the summertime. And my car window was down. So when I pulled in, he opened the gate, came over to the car window, and he said, welcome to the White House, Mr. Williams. And then he said, by the way, did you enjoy your trip to Alaska? I was shocked. I said, yeah, certainly. But I said, how on earth did you know I was in Alaska? He said, Mr. Williams, we know all about you. See? So that was it. See, there I was with a long, slender package that could have been a couple of sticks of dynamite. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And I was in the company of somebody constantly while I was in there. Two of them, young, not FBI, but
Secret Service.
Yeah, they'd look after the presidency.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I went in at first, there was a secretary right inside the door, and they said, Mr. Williams, they're expecting you right at the back desk here. So I went back there, and one of the president's right-hand men was a brother to the governor of Alabama. I can't think of his name at the moment. And he said that the president was now in conference with Senator Dole from Kansas. He said he'd be with you just a little while. He's expecting you, see. So they put me in led me to a beautifully appointed anteroom and gave me a copy of the New York Times and the Washington Post. And in a little while, I was escorted into the room.
Oval Office?
Oval Office. The president came out from behind his desk and walked up to me, put out his hand like this. He said, fellas, I want to apologize to you for keeping you waiting. And on the spur of the moment, I turned to Frazier and I said, Mr. Congressman, I've arrived. I said, any time the President of the United States apologizes to me, I've arrived. And I don't know what prompted me to do it and what gave me the courage to do it, see? But anyway, I got the greatest big hearty laugh out of that you ever saw. So we finally, Congressman Frazier finally gave him a little brief outline and mentioned the Audubon Society as one of my interests. And the president says, Audubon. He said, maybe you'd like to turn and see some of my Audubon prints hanging on the wall. And of course I did and made some appropriate comments. So then I handed him this rod. And before we went in, I said to one of the Secret Service men, I said, would you like to see this rod? He said, I would be thrilled. Because I fish with the president. I'm with him when he fishes and so on. So that was what he was hoping I'd do. He didn't want to ask me to do it. So I took the rod out of the case. Showed it to him. So when we went in, I handed it to the president. Now most people, when they get a hold of a fly rod for the first time, they wiggle it this way.
And side.
Yeah, he just did this, see? He just, in other words, as if he were throwing a lure.
Yeah, a little whipping.
Yeah, lure. That's right, yeah. So he said, well, just exactly right. He said, you see, I got one that's two and a half ounces and it's too light. And I got one 5 ounces and it's too heavy. He said, this is 4 ounces. I said, Mr. President, you missed it by half an ounce, see? And he was thrilled. I said, now, of course, I had George Valaday here, gold plate all the metal parts of the rod and everything. I had saddlery company out here make a leather case to go over the metal case. Mm-hmm. and had a little silver attachment to the case for the President of the United States. So I said, "Mr. President, there's a catch in this gift." He said, "What's that?" I said, "I don't want it in some museum. I want you to use it as a fishing rod." He said, "That's no problem." No problem.
He loved it, didn't he?
I think I've seen, I saw one or two pictures of him trout fishing, and I recognize the rod.
Well, that's good. Where do you come into the bamboo for such a special piece of equipment?
Well, I was getting bamboo at the time. Of course, I was making fishing rods then, yeah. You know. And I was getting bamboo from Horrocks Ibbotson in Utica, New York, and from South Bend Bait Company in South Bend, Indiana, and then one or two other places where I'd get the blanks.
Yeah.
I never did glue up the bamboo, because that took special, you know, equipment and all that. But a bamboo rod is made of about six pieces of bamboo, even if thin tips, that were cut and then glued together, cut on a triangular basis, yeah. And then glued together. And so that's where I got the cane. And of course, I had made any number of fishing rods by then.
Yeah.
The one I made for FDR, I gave to Judge Cummins, and he presented it to him, but it was a deep sea rod. The rod I made for President Truman was a trolling rod, because I knew he fished in Florida a lot. And I pick up the paper and find out one morning that he's at Key West. So I said, it'd be a sin and a shame to give a man a fishing rod when he gets back from a fishing trip. So I said, I'm going to send this down to him at Key West.
That was one of his favorite vacation places.
That's right. So I called Eastern Airlines. And the manager here said he'd be delighted to send the rod down to the president. I had an old friend in Florida who was with a cement company. In the meantime, I didn't know anything about it, but in the meantime, he was made a local vice president of Eastern Airlines. The name skips me for the moment, but he took the rod. Of course, they could take it to Miami, and then they had to fly it almost private plane down to Key West, see? Well, I got acknowledgments from these presidents, signed by them. Mm-hmm. But I got a letter from Truman when he got back to Washington from one of his lesser lights.
Yeah.
And said, the president asked me to thank you for the fishing pole. A fishing pole out of me was a 10-cent bamboo stick, you know. Yeah, I'd spent about $75 on that rod, and he called it a fishing pole.
Well, I'm not so sure that Truman didn't call it a fishing
That's
pole.
That's right.
Lou, we've talked about it in relation to conservation. We've been talking about primarily game and fish and outdoor sports. You have also been greatly interested and concerned with the conservation of natural resources.
That's right.
What is your approach to that? What is your interest in that, your attitude toward conservation of that nature?
Well, of course, the intimate relationship between man and his environment, which includes plants, soil, water, animals, and so forth. They're just inseparable. If it wasn't for the bees, we wouldn't have any apples and so on. So, a natural interest in fish. And game just automatically leads you into these other areas of conservation. You couldn't have good forests without good soil and water and so forth. And the things that that wildlife need are just exactly the same things that man needs. Cover and food and water and so on. So that was just a sort of a natural step for me. I remember a meeting we held one time over at Copper Hill. I never forget my approach coming from the lush greenery of the Smoky Mountains to Chattanooga when on a Sunday morning and raining we came through Copper Hill, and I just couldn't believe that a country could be so devastated as that was. And we held this meeting. Governor Browning was there, and two or three other governors were invited, but none came, but they did send representatives and so forth. And we had this meeting up there. I didn't know too well the heads of the copper company, but I think they were a little skeptical when I first approached them on such a meeting, that we were going to say that they had devastated the country. Well, I finally assured them that that the devastation was caused primarily by the early people who had discovered copper and refined it by using burning wood and so on and so forth. But anyway, it just rained. I never saw such a rain. We had to all duck to our cars, and one man tried to pick up the loudspeaker and got shocked and so forth. But it was a good thing, because we were able to show them what happened when it rained. The clear streams were muddy, and that was the topsoil that was going down the drain, you know. But it was just one of the things that we did to show how the soil and resources could be damaged by carelessness and thoughtlessness and ignorance and so forth.
That is still a devastated area to some degree.
But yeah, but it's
progress.
Oh yeah, it took 100 years to desecrate it, and it's going to take almost that long to bring it back. But they've got a golf course over there now, you know, and they've got some green here and there. But it's a different place than it was. But that was brought about by the cooperation with the company and with TVA and with the State Forestry Division and the United States Forest Service and so forth.
Your long time interest in the area of conservation, what has been, what is your reaction to the interest and concern of business or industry to reasonable conservation measures?
We, I remember when the TNT plant out here was working night and day. I remember when one or two other companies here were poisoning the streams and so on without any intent to do it. And we wanted to approach those people to point out to them that it was just bad public relations for them to desecrate a resource that belonged to all of us. And it wasn't easy, but we did go to one or two companies and found a friendly attitude. And I think we were able to make some progress in that.
You say we...
I'm talking about the Conservation League and so on, see? I remember when the Tennessee Conservation League, the Sears Roebuck Foundation, and the National Wildlife Federation jointly selected me as the Conservationist of the Year for that particular year. I forgot the exact date. And I didn't know a thing about it until I received from the National Wildlife Federation in Washington an invitation to me and my wife to come up there and meet the other 49 state winners and some others. Of course, I went, and at the speaker's table was Governor Nelson Rockefeller, who had been singled out as an outstanding conservationist for his work in cleaning up many of the polluted streams of his state. And next to him, or almost next to him, was Lady Bird Johnson, wife of the then president, who was being recognized for her work in beautifying America. And it was a great meeting. They were to select at that meeting from the 50 state winners a national winner. And of course, just a day or two before that meeting, Martin Ox, wrote a beautiful story about my work and so on, so on, so on. Well, of course,
Martin was editor of the Times at that
time. That time, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And we'd been fishing together and we'd been good friends and so on. And, of course, I knew of some of the work that some of these state winners had done. He didn't know that, and he just felt that I ought to have that honor and predicted it, you know what I mean? But of course, I knew I didn't have a chance, I mean, because some of the other things were so outstanding and so singular, you know, and applicable to the whole subject and so forth, that I forgot now who did win it, but I didn't. That's a cinch.
What you have seemingly, over the years, taken the broadest sort of view. You touched on this a moment ago, but you've taken the broadest possible view of the importance of conservation. What does it really mean to us and to our the people who come after us?
Norman, I think it means everything. I've made a number of talks. Incidentally, get one back to my comments about putting my talks on 3x5 cards and so on and so on. I made a check not too long ago and found that over one period of 10 years that I had made over 500 speeches.
That's one a week.
Yeah, one a week. Sometime I made two or three in one day.
Yeah.
And I remember one time I took a can of green peas out to a garden club where I was going to make a talk. And I mentioned the green peas. I said, there are people so ill-informed that they just think green peas come from a can. They don't think about the thousands of farmers who grew these green peas on hundreds of thousands of acres of land, and of the people who canned them and who shipped them and who sold them and all of that. Green peas don't come from a can. In the same way with milk and other things that are packaged in such a way a lot of the people just don't really know. I remember saying that in the Tennessee Valley we are blessed with a plentiful supply of water, but the states out in the West where water's precious. And I said, we use 5 gallons of water a day to brush our teeth simply because we let the faucet run full blast while we're doing the teeth brushing. We could cut it off each time, you know. That was the way I tried to preach the gospel, by sometimes being dramatic and sometimes kind of getting mad, you know, and so forth, to try really to educate people that this business of our soil, water, forests, and so on is pretty important to us.
Your great interest in Boy Scouting certainly has been one aspect of this general.
That's right. That's right.
Love of the outdoors. Where did you? Did it start with your son as a scout, or had you?
Yeah. Scouting did. Yeah.
Yeah.
That. And then, of course, in Birmingham, I was a member of the Rotary Club. And was chairman of a boys' work committee, and I helped form the boys' club down in Birmingham, and of course was very active in Boy Scouts. And then I organized, and incidentally, Landgraby out here, his daddy and I were awful good friends. He was a vice president of Tennessee Coal Iron Railroad Company, and a conservationist and a good citizen and and interested in boys. We together tried to organize a boys' organization, a boys' work organization, with a member from each of the civic clubs in the area. That included Bessemer and Ensley and so on, see? And we were just in the act of getting that going when I moved.
Here you've been, you've served as president of the local Cherokee Council, or as a chairman, president of the council, Boy Scouts.
Yeah, oh yeah. And then later, I got on the regional committee, which took you in about six states.
And you've been awarded the Silver Beaver and the Silver Buffalo Award.
Not the buffalo, but the antelope.
Antelope.
The buffalo is, you see, the beaver is a local council. The antelope is a regional council, and the buffalo is a national.
Nice.
See? And for a long time, of course, I was the only one who had an antelope here in Chattanooga. Of course, later, the head of the Chattanooga Federal Loan, Arnold Chambers, got real active in scouting, and he got the antelope. And I think we're the only two in Chattanooga that have it.
You have worked very closely over the years with the Chamber of Commerce. Did you serve as president, Lou?
Oh, yeah.
You were president.
I was president in 1960.
That's what I did not locate that date. What is your feeling about the place of a business organization in developing programs of total interest to the community? Do they tend to take a broad enough view?
I would say that as a whole, they don't. They seem, not speaking now about any company, any particular company, they seem to specialize in the areas that are most beneficial to them. I guess that's a perfectly normal attitude. But every now and then you'll find companies that are interested on either a local basis or a state basis, or a statewide basis, or a national basis. For instance, there's not many people that will remember the old Nash automobile. But for a few years, they gave an award on a national basis to people who have been outstanding in conservation work and so forth and so forth. I guess their particular interest was the use of the car for picnicking and fishing and hunting and so on. And they gave me that certificate one year. Which to me showed a national interest in a what might be considered a local problem. See?
Sure. What was some of the main interests of the Chamber of Commerce during your year as president?
Well,
did you have any particularly large project you had in mind?
Any large project that we had in mind in that particular year would have gone awry, because right in mid-year I had to change the executive directors. And the outgoing director for 3 or 4 months wasn't interested enough to start anything new. And of course, the incoming director had to spend 3 or 4 months getting oriented and acclimated. So, but we did do some work on what we thought was an important thing, and that was try to improve the relationship between the city and county governments. We did that with some meetings and so on and so on. And at that particular time, we thought that the relationship between the two governments was very, very poor. That, I guess, was about the only thing that we were able to accomplish, although the...
Now, this was 1960.
Was it 19? Yeah, yeah.
1960.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, I must say that that is still a topic of continuing interest.
Well, I'm sure of that. Yeah, I'm sure of that.
To work for closer cooperation between the two governments.
One, I was chairman of the Forestry and Recreation Committee of the Chamber for a number of years. We alternated. I would be chairman 1 year, Carter Patton the next, Wilbur Butts the next, and so on. And I remember, of course, one of the things that we had worked awful hard for, that I personally had worked awful hard for, was making a park out of Moxon Bend. I was very friendly then with Governor Browning. And I went to him one day, and I mentioned what a great thing this would be, not only for Chattanooga, but for the country at large and the people of the state, making a park out of Moxon Bend. We had two appraisers made on the land. That's the whole bend. That was before the hospital went over there.
Yeah.
And it was right around $200,000. I asked Governor Browning if he would put up $100,000 of state funds, provided I could get the county in the city. I think the appraisal was about $250,000 to appropriate $50,000 apiece, which made up $200,000, and I got the Kiwanis Club to agree to raise the rest of it to make the bend a park. All right, I took Thrasher, who was head of the county, and Hugh Abercrombie, who was running against him, and Wasson was mayor, and Rudy O'Jotti running against him. And I put them all in the same car and took them to Nashville to talk to the governor. And they all agreed. When they got into it, they had to have an act of the legislature to enable the county, or to enable the city, to condemn the land on Moxon Bend. And both governments felt that the other one ought to do it, in other words. So it took an act of the legislature now to get this done. That took 2 years.
I know.
Well, we finally passed the bill, and I talked to the governor then, and he said, "I'm going to sign the bill tomorrow." He was going out of office the next day. "If you'll come up in the morning, I'll give you, see that you get the state check. Well, I went, and of course, the Times had a photographer with me and all. And of course, the governor's office was crowded. The ante room was crowded. And as I say, he was going out of office maybe that same afternoon. I don't remember that now, but either that or the next day. So he came in after a little bit. I mean, come out after a little bit to tell me that we weren't going to get the check. And he was mad. Governor Clement's father, acting for the governor, stopped it. I had no quarrel with that because Clement was not consulted about it at all. In other words, this was a Browning project, see? And I thought that it was all set, in other words, see? So they stopped it, and he was just as bad as he could be. I'd already had a picture made by the Times, because they had to go out. They were getting photographs all over the town, you know.
Yeah.
And so on. And I had this beautiful picture of me getting this check from the governor, you know. But the check money.